That is the radio station that I still feel closest to. That's part of me. Why don't we do a programme about pets? That's what we really need. We need a programme about pets. We've not been paid, so we're just taking the equipment and they just walk out.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Ian Rufus.
I think my earliest memory of radio is that my parents had below the sort of 7-inch black and white television. They had a little oak radio, but the volume control on it was broken. Even if you had it turned up to its maximum volume, you could hardly hear it. So the only way to hear it was to get down on your hands and knees and put your ear to the loudspeaker. And from about the age of 4 or 5, I remember particularly Saturday mornings spent on my hands and knees with my ear up against the speaker, listening in particular to Uncle Mac's children's favourites, so you can tell how old I am.
Hello, children. Everywhere, this is Uncle Mac. Good morning to you all.
So, listening to songs like The Runaway Train and The Laughing Policeman, and one in particular that I always remember, which I think was called Mama's on the Warpath.
Mama's on the warpath. Mama's fighting mad.
It was about a mother losing a temper with the kids, and it ended up with her smashing plates. And I would have been 4 or 5 at the time. And as soon as the plate smashing started, I was absolutely terrified. Mama's on the warpath. I used to run upstairs and hide under my parents' bed. I think that was my first sort of exposure to
and stay out.
The power of audio, if you like. Being a baby boomer, I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg under the bed covers at night, hear that awful medium wave signal fading in and out.
208 metres on the medium wave band.
Lots of sponsored programmes. And then when Radio 1 started, just being absolutely addicted to Radio 1 for so many years. I remember the very opening day, Tony Blackburn and Flowers in the Rain, getting up early on Saturday morning to listen to Radio 1 coming on air for the first time and being just incredibly excited by it. Incredibly excited.
Number 3 this week in the Radio 1 Fun 30, and it comes, of course, from the movies called Flowers in the Rain. 3 minutes now past 7 o'clock on the first of the Tony Blackburn shows.
For as long as I can remember, I'd always wanted to be a journalist, a print journalist. And my father was an accountant on a newspaper in Doncaster, and he used to take me into the newspaper on a Saturday morning. I used to love the smell of the newsprint in the newspaper office. Now, I just found it hugely addictive, and we used to walk through the newsroom. I just found the whole thing incredibly exciting and romantic. And that's really all I ever wanted to do, just be a print journalist. When I left school at 16, I applied to the local newspaper in Rotherham. And I remember going to see the editor. He interviewed me for an hour, and I'll never forget. I was wearing a brown corduroy jacket, and he said to me, "Are you going to a bohemian art party after this interview?" Anyway, at the end of the interview, he said, "What you need to do is go out and get a year's experience in the real world. So go and get yourself another job." So I went to become a management trainee at a steelworks in Sheffield, which I actually loved for a year. Really, really enjoyed it. A year later, I went knocking back on the editor's door at the local paper in Rotherham and said, "Remember me? You told me to get a year's experience in the real world. Well, I have done, and I'm back." He signed me up for a 3.5-year apprenticeship. My father had to go down and sign a parchment document which sort of tied me to this newspaper for 3.5 years until I got the qualification from the National Council for the Training of Journalists, which I did. It was a great time. It really was. But all I wanted to do was stay in newspapers. So at the end of the 3.5 years, I applied for a job on the Birmingham Post, which is virtually defunct now, but it was the morning newspaper in Birmingham. As big in its day as the Manchester Guardian used to be. It was huge. But then it was a 6-day-a-week paper. Very, very popular. I was there for 18 months. Circulation was beginning to steadily fall, and they had a round of redundancies. And they did it on the basis of last in, first out. And as I was one of the newest recruits, I was the first one out. I got no idea what to do, but somebody had told me on the grapevine that there was a job going at the newly opened BBC local radio station, BBC Radio Birmingham.
"Good morning, everybody. This is BBC Radio Birmingham, your local radio station for Birmingham, Coventry, Wolverhampton and the Black Country."
I went along for an interview, and the interview seemed to go fine, but I never heard another Dickie Bird out of them. And I thought, oh, well, that's it. So I applied for a job as a feature writer on the Newcastle Journal in Newcastle upon Tyne. And I'd been up there probably about 4 or 5 months writing features for this morning newspaper in Newcastle. And I suddenly got a telephone call from Roger Clark, who was the news editor of Radio Birmingham. And he said, do you remember coming in for an interview about 4 or 5 months ago? And I said, yes. And he said, are you still interested in the job? Because we'd like to offer it to you. And I said, I'm quite happy up here now, Roger. I said, you know, and I've left Birmingham and I don't think I'm interested. Thank you very much indeed. Just as I was about to hang up the phone, I thought, I really ought to ask how much they're offering. So I said, just before you go, what's the salary? And he said, £30 a week. Now I was on £27.50 at the Newcastle Journal. So I said, I'll take it.
First, your local headlines. Worley's chief dental officer is definitely going to stand for election to Birmingham City Council.
And they were strange times, because it was the very, very early days of BBC local radio, 1970. There was a feeling that no one was listening. You see, it was a sort of an academic exercise to go into the office and produce these programmes and put them out, because we just couldn't believe that really that anybody actually bothered to tune in those early days. But they were very enjoyable years at the BBC, but I found the whole BBC ethos very stultifying. It was like being a civil servant more than being a journalist. And you just had the feeling, and I was sort of reasonably ambitious. I mean, I wasn't wildly ambitious, but, you know, I wanted to progress my career. And I just couldn't stand that sort of civil service atmosphere. One of the things that really, really turned me off the BBC in those days was the fact that a very good friend of mine was the news editor of the Birmingham Post. Well, he was the ex-news editor of the Birmingham Post, a chap called Malcolm Totten. He had a really deep-rooted interest in the history of the West Midlands and the Black Country in particular. He and a friend of his, who was a folk singer, had written a musical about the Black Country nail-making industry. And he wanted to make a record of the songs from the musical that he'd written. So I said, well, I'll see if BBC Radio Birmingham will let us use some studio time. We'll see if we can get an album pressed. We recorded this album, and it's called The Nail Makers. We had the cover printed, and there was a lot of blurb on the back. I arranged to have put on the bottom a BBC Radio Birmingham Enterprise. It seemed to be fine, because that's what it was. The record came out, and it probably sold half a dozen copies. I mean, it was of limited interest. But the BBC Suits heard about it in London. And when they saw that we'd had the temerity to put a BBC Radio Birmingham Enterprise on the bottom of this album, they went berserk. They just went absolutely ape about it. The station manager was summoned down to London. I was given the biggest dressing down. I thought, what is this all about? I mean, I've got a bit of publicity for the radio station. I thought, I can't stand this anymore. I just cannot stand it anymore. So I thought, but what am I going to do? Because, you know, if I leave BBC Radio Birmingham in high dudgeon, the only other radio station I can go and work on is another BBC local radio station. So that's probably not going to happen now.
And on this groovy Saturday morning, you're listening to John Henry and to Leslie Ross. Stay tuned, because there's more good sound to come.
They'd just begun talking about commercial radio, about legal land-based commercial radio, and I thought, well, I'll bide my time at the BBC a little bit and I'll just see what comes up. After about a year, those sort of murmurings and rumours started to turn into the reality of commercial radio, and they announced the first licence award, which is to the London Broadcasting Company.
It's the first station of the Independent Broadcasting Authority's local radio service, and the first all-news radio station in this country.
So I thought, I'm going to apply to this new commercial radio company. So I sent off an application to be news editor, and I thought, I don't stand a cat in hell's chance. I've just got 3 years' experience as a news producer on a BBC local radio station out in the sticks, as I'm sure they would have regarded Birmingham down in London then. But to my amazement, I had a letter back, almost by return of post, saying, come down for an interview. I was interviewed, and it all seemed to go reasonably okay, and I came back home again. When I arrived back home, my wife said to me, oh, you've had a telephone call from LBC, they'd like you to call them back. So I rang them back, and they said, we'd like to offer the job as news editor. Well, if I, was absolutely flabbergasted. I thought, oh my God, you know, what have I done? You know, I just don't have that level of experience. But I thought, well, they've offered me the job now, so I might as well take it. So I wrote and I accepted the job. And about 2 weeks later, I had a phone call from the guy who'd interviewed me for the job as news editor. When he called me, I thought, they've found me out. They've discovered, actually, that they've appointed a talentless nitwit and they want to withdraw the offer of employment. And they said, you know, I accepted the job as news editor. And I said, yes. And he said, well, would you be interested in taking the post, the next post up, which is duty editor, which is in charge of a whole shift on the radio station? And I was hesitating. And then they told me what the salary was, which was a considerable increase in what I'd already accepted as news editor. So I said yes, and I thought, well, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, if it all goes horribly wrong, it all goes horribly wrong.
This is London Broadcasting, the news and information voice of independent radio.
And as soon as it came on air, you knew it was just going to be a complete and utter disaster. The big problem was that of all the people that they'd taken on as journalists, I was about the only one with any previous radio experience. And my radio experience was 3 years on a BBC local radio station. Now, we've got some very talented people, people like John Snow, who was a copywriter.
The siege here has just ended 1 minute ago. There is still...
Janet Street Porter. Very, very talented people, but none of them had any radio experience. John Snow was working part-time for a charity in London and used to cycle into work with his bicycle clips on and... But the place was just chaotic. It was just a total nightmare. Chaos. Now, as someone who had a little bit of radio experience, they turned to me to be the first father of the chapel, which is sort of shop steward with the National Union of Journalists. And suddenly I found myself as senior shop steward on this radio station that was getting national attention because... labour relations were not good.
Owing to an industrial dispute, normal services on both LBC and Independent Radio News have been suspended for the time being.
There were all sorts of constant threats of journalists walking out. I'd had very little experience of dealing with the press, and yet we were being called all hours of the day and night by national newspapers saying, you know, is LBC going to go off the air? And it was just shocking. How the station managed to survive that first year is still beyond me in many ways, because towards the end of my time there, journalists weren't being paid. And I remember sitting at my desk in the newsroom one day and seeing journalists who'd been on the previous shift to me coming in, going into the studios, walking out with tape recorders, microphones, typewriters. And when I said to them, where are you going with those? And they said, we've not been paid, so we're just taking the equipment. And they just walk out. The place was just being systematically stripped bare.
We hope to resume our regular programming as soon as possible.
And then they brought in a guy called Marshall Stewart from the Today programme, I think, at Radio 4, who started to turn things around, and Ron Onions, who was the original news editor at Capital Radio. He was brought in as well to churn up the newsroom and help turn things around. And that was the beginning of the new beginning for LBC.
The situation here at LBC was not good, and an approach would be made to me to come to this station. No, I said, not that.
And then right out of the blue, Bill McDonald, who was the original managing director of Radio Hallam, suddenly rang me and said, I hear you're an ex-South Yorkshire lad. I'm launching this radio station in Sheffield. Would you be interested in the news editor's job? And I said, I'll be on the next train. Bill and I got on like a house on fire. I started at Hallam as the original head of news with Keith Skews as programme director.
On Radio Hallam, you'll get the news fast. Whether it's a new government in Romania or a new council in Rotherham, you'll hear about it first on Radio Hallam.
Before a radio station was allowed to go on air in those days, the IBA used to send in an engineering team who used to test the acoustics of the studios. And I remember this incredibly officious engineer from the IBA and they'd put up this white noise generating machine outside the main on-air studio and switched it on. And apparently their incredibly sensitive equipment could pick up the faintest, tiniest murmurings from this white noise generating machine outside the studio. A listener in a million years could never have detected that there was any problem at all. And this was being done the day before the radio station was due to go on air. And this engineer was saying to me and to Keith Skews and to Bill McDonald, we can't allow you to go on air tomorrow. And we said, well, we've got television advertising booked. We've got press advertising booked. Everybody's expecting that. Sorry, can't go on air tomorrow. Bill, who, you know, was generally speaking a very, very mild-mannered individual, I remember him virtually squaring up to this engineer and saying, you know, I'll have you thrown off the premises. I will lock the doors and we will go on air whether you like it or not. Now, I can't remember whether we actually managed to do some work to the studio to block out the noise or whether the IBA backed down, but we certainly went on air the next day to great acclaim.
A very good morning. Radio Hallam is on the air. It's 6 a.m. and from this moment we're commencing broadcasting programmes on frequencies of 194 metres medium wave, 1,546 kilohertz and 95.2 megahertz FM in VHF stereo.
Hallam was a very odd radio station in many ways. It was largely populated by ex-BBC radio presenters like Roger Moffat.
So on behalf of all of us here at Radio Hallam in Sheffield, may we wish you all a very good night.
Very, very big names in their day, but who'd sort of slightly slipped from grace in some respects. And there was, I wouldn't say a constant battle, but there was a bit of spikiness between myself and Keith Skews, because Keith was very, very interested in the entertainment side of the radio station. And he'd got very, very fixed ideas about the way the radio station should sound. He wasn't that interested in the news side.
The tolerance levels in oldies is very different to current singles, and that the rotation should be made that much faster.
And I was a young, feisty news editor who thought that news was the absolute be-all and end-all of any radio station. So I used to really, really, really fight the corner hard for the station's news content. And that didn't always go down too well with Keith. But, you know, we got on okay. I think if I was back working now in commercial radio, I wouldn't know how to run a newsroom because I was so used to having journalists at beck and call. Although having said that, of course, we needed them then because we were required to do 24-hour-a-day news. We were doing a five-minute news bulletin every single hour, 24 hours a day, and a half-hour news programme every evening, which had to be filled. So there was a need, because the IBA, the Independent Broadcasting Authority, of course, insisted that we did that sort of output.
During that time, you were working with a young journalist called Ralph Bernard, who was to make his name with GWR in later life. And he worked on a documentary series at Hallam called Dying for a Drink, didn't he? Tell me about that.
It was an excellent piece of work, and it was networked around and won Hallam and Ralph a lot of plaudits.
Albert today is still not drinking. He attends his Alcoholics Anonymous meetings religiously and offers advice and help to others like him.
And as a result of that, I was asked to go down to London to speak to a gathering of managing directors and programme directors by the IBA and talk about speech programming. And one of the examples I used was some of Ralph's work on Dying for a Drink. Immediately after I'd done this presentation, I was approached by John Bradford, who was the newly appointed managing director designate of the new local radio franchise for Coventry in Warwickshire. And he said, would I be interested in the programme director's job? And there'd been a hiatus in the development of commercial radio. They'd allowed 19 radio stations to go on the air, and then the government had said, no more, we'll assess how well they're doing. So there were 19 stations on air, and then the break was taken off, and franchises were awarded to CBC in Cardiff and to the group that was called Midland Community Radio, which eventually became Mercia. I said, yes, I would be interested. So I went down for an interview with the board. A couple of days later, John Bradford was on the phone, and he said, we'd like to offer you the job. Now, Coventry was a a very, very interesting problem to take on from a radio point of view. I didn't know the city at all. All I really knew was that Coventry was 15 miles, 20 miles away from Birmingham. But I very, very quickly learnt that Coventry had a big, big chip on its shoulder about Birmingham. It felt it was the sort of poor relation to Birmingham. Because Birmingham in the 70s had really sort of begun to pull itself up by its bootstraps, and it had turned from this dour metal bashing city into, you know, what has now become a world-class city. There's no doubt about it. But that was just starting, and Coventry was sort of trying to ride on its coattails, but never quite got it right. That sense of injustice, if you like, was also fuelled by the fact that the BBC local radio service came from Birmingham. There was no BBC local radio station in Coventry at the time. The local television came from Birmingham, both BBC and ITV. So when I got there as programme director, I decided that the best way that we were going to succeed was we were going to be absolutely 100% about Coventry and Warwickshire. We would almost pretend that Birmingham didn't exist. We were going to try and give it back a sense of its own identity. Now, I got no idea really whether it was going to work or not, but that's what we did. And we hired a great team of presenters. There was Gordon Astley on breakfast. There was Tony Gillam, Dave Jameson, who we poached from BRMB. I mean, some really big local radio names.
Britain's 21st independent local radio station is launched today with the opening of Mercia Sound, covering Coventry, Warwickshire and part of Leicestershire. It means an early start to the day for a class of Coventry school children.
This radio station launched in May 1980. Somewhere I've still got a tape, which is excruciatingly embarrassing, of me being the first voice on Mercia. And I'm sort of making this announcement that for the very first time in Coventry and Warwickshire, Mercia Sound. I thought, nobody speaks like that on the radio anymore. But it seemed absolutely right at the time.
For the very first time, good morning from Mercia Sound.
The initial response seemed to be promising, and we got a lot of feedback. And then we came to the first JICRA, as it then was. And the results came in, and John Bradford called me into his office, and I thought, oh dear, this is going to be bad news. And he said, have a guess what the weekly reach is. I said, I don't know, 25%, 30%, which would have been great, I mean, in those days. He said, 54% weekly reach. I just couldn't believe it, just could not believe it. 54% of everybody who lived in the transmission area were tuning in at some time during the course of the week. And I just remember getting very, very drunk in the boardroom that evening. And then the next audience research came in, and it was 60%. And that's a figure that still holds the record for any radio station in England and Wales to this day. I think Radio Clyde beat us by a couple of percent, but they were in Scotland, so they didn't count. The original franchise group is called Midland Community Radio, and that's exactly what the radio station set itself up to be in its original application, as a community radio station. Before the station had launched, they hadn't just had a small number of shareholders. They'd made a point of going out and allocating shares to individuals who, in some cases, just bought £100 worth of shares. And these people really thought they got a real vested interest in what the radio station was doing. And so once a year, the board used to convene a meeting, and about 200 people used to turn up. And they'd say things like, why aren't we doing a programme about pets? That's what we really need. We need a programme about pets. And so I'd sort of and try and skirt my way around it. And then somebody else would stand up and say, we should be doing far more local history, far more local history. They were interesting meetings, and people really, really thought that they had a right, which they did, you know, I mean, that's what they bought their shares for. I think some of the most interesting and challenging aspects of working on a radio station back in the 80s was the sort of overriding influence of the Independent Broadcasting Authority on us. I mean, I remember before Mercia came on the air, about 2 weeks before we came on the air, we had to submit our initial programme schedule to the IBA, and I sent ours down. And then I was summoned down to the IBA to see, I can't remember what his title was, head of programming or whatever it was at the IBA. And we went out for lunch in a pub in Knightsbridge, and he'd got the programme schedule, and he'd gone through it, and he said, yes, very, very good, yeah, like that. What we'd like to see is an hour of classical music programming every lunchtime. And I said, we're not doing that. And he said, well, I'm not going to approve the programme schedule unless you do an hour of classical music programme every lunchtime. And I said, we'll do some classical music programme, but I'm not doing an hour of it every day. And he said, well, I won't approve the programme schedule then. And I said, what if you do a two-hour programme on a Sunday evening? No, we want an hour of programming, an hour of classical music every lunchtime. It's just outrageous when you think about it now that they could decide what this radio station was going to be doing. You know, that they got no experience of Coventry. They'd just given us the franchise. So I said, well, we're not doing it. So I got on the train, came out to Coventry, and I said to John Bradford, they're not going to approve the programme schedule unless we do an hour of classical music programme. And I'm just frankly not prepared to do it. And he said, well, stick to your guns. Anyway, the IBA blinked first, and they came back and said, well, if you agree to do, I can't remember if it's 2 hours or 3 hours on a Sunday evening, then, and if you'll drop in the odd classical music track, you know, where appropriate during daytime scheduling, then we'll give it the okay.
You're listening to test transmissions from the Independent Broadcasting Authority. These transmissions are in preparation for the new independent local radio service for Coventry and the surrounding area.
But we'd originally wanted to call the radio station WKCV. We didn't want to call it Mercia. We wanted to call it WKCV, standing for Warwickshire, WK and CV, Coventry. But the radio the Independent Broadcasting Authority had the last word on what you call the radio station. And they said, you're not calling it WKCV. And I said, why not? And they said, because it sounds too American, far too American. You've got to give it a proper name. And I said, what's wrong with WKCV? You're not calling it WKCV. So we called it Mercia in the end, because the buffet at Coventry Railway Station was called the Mercia Buffet. So I thought, that'll do. Mercia, 2-2-0, playing on your radio. I'd been at Mercia for several years, and I was, you know, pretty ambitious, and I'd been a programme director for a few years, and I wanted to be a managing director. And then right out of the blue, I was approached again by Bill McDonald, who was part of the newly awarded franchise for Humberside, and it's a group called Humber Bridge Radio, based in Hull. And I went up for an interview there, they offered me the job, and I became the first managing director of Humber Bridge Radio, which eventually became Viking Radio.
Over the past year, the board of Viking Radio have brought together a team of professional broadcasters and supporting staff to ensure that this new radio station is comprehensive, entertaining and informative.
But I very, very quickly came to realise that I wasn't that much in love with Hull. Because it's a very strange place, is Hull, because unless you're going to Hull, there's no other reason for ever visiting it. You don't pass through Hull because it's at the end of the road. Then it was a very, very insular city. But we set about the job of launching this radio station, and we bought some premises and started to do the donkey work. My then wife was desperately unhappy in Hull, so I was very conscious of that. And then right out of the blue, and I'd only been there about 3 or 4 months, the board at Mercia rang me to say that John Bradford, who was the original managing director at Mercia, had handed in his notice to go to Radio West, or what was then Radio West in Bristol. Was I interested in coming back as managing director? So I said, yes, I was. So I handed in my notice to a rather annoyed board at Humber Bridge Radio and came back to Mercia in 1983. During that time, I mean, the radio station was very, very profitable. We really turned it into a little money-making machine. During the time that I was there, the then managing director at BRMB, who was a guy called David Pinnell, who'd been there at BRMB since day one, used to ring me up on a sort of twice-weekly basis and say things like, Ian, how much are you paying for your copy paper in the newsroom? And I'd say, well, we've done this deal with a local station and we pay, you know, £100 for 2 tonnes of it. That's a very, very good deal. You must put me on to these people. Then he'd ring me up the next week and say, how much are your journalists being paid? And I'd tell him, how'd you get away with that? And I'd say, well, you just negotiate with them and, you know, we offer them little perks. Thank you for that. I'll do the same in my newsroom. Anyway, he was coming up to retirement. And I think because we'd struck up this sort of rapport where I think he looked at me as a sort of cheeky young Turk who was running this little radio station down the road, but was obviously, you know, making quite a fist of it. He said, would I be interested in applying for his job when he retired? So I thought, blimey, you know, Mercy is one thing, but to, you know, go to a station like BRMB, which was one of the big five radio stations, that is a huge step. But I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound. So I went along for the interview. And it was in the days when most people smoked. It was also the days when you didn't even bother to ask if it was okay if you could smoke, because everybody did and it was just a natural thing to do. And I remember going for the interview at the Holiday Inn in Birmingham with the BRMB board. And during the course of the interview, I just lit up a cigar, because I used to smoke Hamlet cigars in those days. And I lit up a cigar, smoked it, and then lit up another one, smoked it, and got to the end of the interview and we shook hands and I went away. And a couple of days later, they rang me and said, would I come back for a second interview? So a couple of weeks later, turned up again. And the managing director's secretary, who was sort of checking in the applicants as they came in for their second interview, said, oh, you're next, Mr. Rufus. The chairman has asked me to say to you before you go in, would you mind this time if you didn't smoke during the interview? And I thought, oh, dear, that's... I've probably blown it again. So I didn't smoke during the interview and they offered me the job. BRMB, lucky breaks. So I joined BRMB in 1986. BRMB was a long established radio station then. It wasn't a new station. To take over an existing station of the size and the influence that BRMB had at the time was quite a daunting task. I know when I walked in, I was treated with a lot of suspicion. A, because I'd come from this tiddly little radio station down the road. And also because a number of the senior managers had applied for the managing director's job and hadn't been successful. And so were deeply suspicious and I suspect rather resentful of me. Commercial radio stations are very, very political places, as we know, and they can be very, very poisonous places. And I learnt a long, long time ago that the best way to deal with that is to ignore the poison, because you know it's there, you know people are talking behind your back. If you lose sleep at night worrying about what people may or may not be saying about you and about your management style, then you're going to get nothing done. So I resolved many, many years ago that I would just ignore all that and just try and get on with the job.
What was your management style?
I think my management style has always been relatively relaxed. I'd like to say I'm a believer in sort of benign dictatorship. I've never been afraid, I hope I've never been afraid, to appoint people who are better at the job than I am, doing a particular job than I personally would be able to do, because I think that's the best way to get things done. And so, I just as one example, Phil Riley was features editor at BRMB when I arrived. And very, very quickly, he went off to do an MBA at Columbia University in New York. And he came back as a very, very astute businessman. There came a time with radio stations when the government felt that radio stations were wasting their frequencies and they couldn't see why it was that we were broadcasting the same programming on FM as we were on AM. And the sort of edict use it or lose it came into play. So you had to come up with a different way of using your AM frequency to your FM to broaden listener choice. And we came up with the idea of an oldies radio station called Extra AM.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 4th of April, 1989. I'm Les Ross. Welcome to XTRA Extra AM.
We put Phil in charge of it, and Phil did an absolutely amazing job. He did a far better job, I know, than I could have ever have done personally with that radio station.
And by this time, the industry was changing.
The mood was changing. When I'd arrived BRMB, one of the first questions I was asked by the Birmingham Evening Mail was, you've come from Coventry, where you've been running Mercia. Will you be taking Mercia over? And the thought had never occurred to me. It just never occurred to me at all. But that sort of set a seed in my mind. The only mergers or takeovers that the IBA had really allowed up until that point was where a successful radio station was going in to save a failing radio station. And it was just seen as, you know, that was all they would ever allow. But the mood was changing. There was a feeling that for radio stations to continue to prosper, they had to grow in size. And if they were to grow in size, one of the most obvious routes was to acquire other radio stations. And so after a couple of years, I approached Stuart Linnell, who was the managing director of Mercia, who'd succeeded me at Mercia, and said, what about if we got together? I'm not talking about BRMB taking Mercia over, because I know that the Mercia board would probably never agree to that. But what about a merger? And Stuart said he would think about it. So he went away and thought about it and spoke to his board. And we reached agreement pretty quickly. And the IBA, not to my amazement, but to my slight surprise, I think, approved it without a murmur. We formed what I think was then the first merger of two radio stations, neither of which were in trouble at the time. We went on to be pretty successful together. I don't think, in all honesty, we exploited the advantages of the merger as well as we possibly could have done. I think Mercia was still fiercely protective of its own independence. It wanted to continue to do its own programming, quite rightly so. And although they were taking Extra AM on their medium wave, on their AM transmitter, Stuart was quite keen to do some local programming rather than have this sort of region-wide oldest station. He wanted it to be somehow Coventry branded. We never did do that, but Stuart was quite keen to do that. But still, there was this mood within the industry to consolidate. And there seemed to be a period of about 6 or 8 months towards the end of the 80s where I seemed to do nothing else but go and meet with managing directors of other radio stations or be approached by other radio stations with a view to merging.
Across in Wolverhampton, Beacon was very much doing its own thing. What was the relationship like?
Fiery, feisty, to say the least. Our transmission areas overlapped in the Black Country. And Beacon, and I think we to a certain extent were also guilty of this, we used to try and encroach on each other's territories. And so I won't say there was bad blood between Beacon and BRMB, but there were quite a few testy exchanges between senior management on a fairly regular basis about, you know, why are you doing an outside broadcast in Aston, you know, right outside BRMB studios, when you're a Wolverhampton, the Black Country radio station? And then we'd do all sorts of promotions in the Black Country, which they objected to. Serving the West Midlands. As I say, it wasn't bad blood, but there was a lot of head-to-head competition, which sometimes used to boil over. Beacon Radio. Everybody seemed to be looking to merge with everybody else. And I remember I went up to Glasgow for talks with Jimmy Gordon to see if there was any possibility of a merger between Clyde and BRMB. Quite what the affinity would have been with a radio station in Glasgow and one in Birmingham. I can't even begin to think. We got very, very close to doing a merger with Piccadilly Radio, to the point where a lot of people thought it was a done deal. And as a result, bought shares in Piccadilly Radio because they'd heard the whispers. which triggered an insider dealing inquiry by the stock exchange, which resulted in the sales director at Mercia, who, unbeknown to me or anybody else, had just gone out and bought shares in Piccadilly on the assumption that as soon as the deal was announced, Piccadilly's share price would go through the roof. He became, as far as I know, the first and one of only a tiny, tiny handful of people who've ever been successfully prosecuted for insider dealing. The guy's sadly dead now. That was terrible. But that proposed merger with Piccadilly fell at the final hurdle because Owen Oyston, who was effectively owned Red Rose Radio in Preston at the time, came in and whisked Piccadilly Radio away from under our noses and took over Piccadilly Radio.
The update at 2 o'clock. I'm Joanna Hartley. It seems likely that Lancashire millionaire Owen Oyston's won his $39 million takeover bid for the Piccadilly Radio Group. His Miss World group seems certain to take over Piccadilly after the radio station's shareholders.
So the Piccadilly deal died. How had you felt about linking up with Manchester?
Not particularly enthusiastic. I got on okay with Colin Walters, who was the MD at Piccadilly at the time. But whether we'd have worked together long term, I'm not really sure. I wasn't that enthusiastic about it. In fact, I wasn't desperately enthusiastic about merging with anybody, quite honestly. I think I would have just loved it if we could have just carried chugging along in our own sweet, independent way. And I remember once, after an ARC meeting, Association of Independent Radio Contractors, which was the employer's trade body at the time, I'd been for a meeting down there, and Ralph Bernard, who was then MD of the up-and-coming but still very small GWR, we went for a drink after this meeting, and he said, "Do you reckon there'd be any point in GWR and BR&B and Mercia getting together?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know, Ralph, I'm not really sure, I'll have to think about it." So I went away and thought about it, and I thought, well, I'm duty-bound to tell the board. And the chairman of BR&B and I went down for a meeting with the chairman of GWR and Ralph. And the meeting went fine, but I remember on the way back talking John Parkinson, who was the chairman of BR&B at the time, talking him out of doing the deal because I didn't want to merge with GWR either. So the board turned down that approach. With hindsight, had we gone ahead with the merger, I would have probably been a lot wealthier than I am today. But you know, you make these decisions and you have to stand by them. The board was sort of, well, you know, we'll leave it up to you. And if you come to us with a deal that we like, then we'll seriously consider it. Again, I'd been down to an Association of Independent Radio Contractors meeting, and I'd been talking to Ron Coles, who's the managing director of the group of radio stations in the East Midlands, Trent and Derby and Leicester. I honestly cannot remember to this day whose suggestion it was, but we began talking about the possibility of a merger. And suddenly it seemed to make sense that here we could have all the radio stations in the Midlands grouped together. We could sell them together to advertisers. It just seemed to be blindingly obvious that if we were to do a merger with anybody, then a merger between the East and the West Midlands made a huge amount of sense. I rang Ron and I said, I'm warming to the idea. And one summer's afternoon, he came over to my house and we sat in my back garden and we hammered out a deal between us. And he would become group chief executive. I was going to be deputy group chief executive. And there was an understanding that in terms of running the day-to-day operations, he would look after the East and I would look after the West, and there wouldn't be any undue interference. So we went to our respective boards and we did the deal, and we brought the two radio stations together as Midlands Radio. It worked very well. It was a good sell. Advertisers could see what they were buying. They were effectively buying the whole of the Midlands East and West television region. In audience terms, it didn't make a great deal of difference. It made no difference at all to the average listener because they were still listening to BR&B in Birmingham. They were listening to Trent in Nottingham and so on, Leicester Sound. And so successful was it that we eventually floated it on the stock market very, very successfully. That was hard work. I mean, not in terms of the sell, but in terms of putting the whole thing together. Talk about, you know, sitting in London solicitors' offices at 3 o'clock in the morning waiting for faxes to come through. And that whole Midlands Radio grouping was a great success. But again, consolidation was in the air. And then suddenly we were approached by Capital Radio. Capital Radio were very, very interested in buying the entire group. We started talks with them, and eventually those talks came to fruition. They bought the group for, I think it was £18 million, which was a great deal for the Midlands Radio shareholders at the time. It was a fantastic deal. I wouldn't say they exactly snatched Capital's hands off, but they came as close to doing that as it was possible to be. And we became part of the Capital Radio Group.
So after all those years of running your own ship and your own board, you were owned by Capital. How did that feel?
A great deal of uncertainty, because Richard Eyre, who was the managing director of Capital at the time, was, to coin the old cliche, a real gentleman and a scholar. He was an extremely honourable chap. But at the end of the day, these were their radio stations now, and they were going to do what they wanted to do with them. Richard Park, who was the group programme director, and I'd worked with Richard on and off for a long, long time, and we were on the... I was chair of the AIRC programming committee, and Richard was a very active and incredibly useful member of that committee. And it was, you know, during Richard's time and my time as chairman of the programming committee that we came up with the idea and launched the chart show, which was just phenomenally successful, you know, the network chart show across the whole of the UK commercial radio network.
Hi there, it's David Kid Jensen here with the very first network chart show coming at you right across the nation on independent radio. Now, every Sunday afternoon...
But Richard had a very, very clear idea of what he wanted to do. And I think I got my first taste of the way that Capital Radio operated when we'd come to a point where Les Ross's contract had to be renegotiated. And, you know, I won't break any confidences by talking about the sums of money that we were talking about, but suffice it to say that we'd been paying Les a certain amount of money. Les didn't do his own negotiations. He had an agent who came in and negotiated. The negotiations went through this similar dance every year where Les's agent would say, Les isn't prepared to continue to work for BRMB for any less than... And I'd say, well, we're not prepared to pay any more than X. And then we'd meet somewhere in the middle. And that's how it used to be every year.
96.4 FM, BRMB. The 8 o'clock news with Roger Walker.
Anti-terrorist squad officers in...
Just after Capital Radio took over and Richard was starting to get to grips with the way that he wanted to programme BRMB, Les's contract came up for negotiation. I remember saying to Richard, well, this is the way that it normally works, Richard. And he said, OK, well, I'll speak to him. And I said, well, Les won't speak to you, I have to speak to his agent. And he said, I'll speak to Les. Richard spoke to Les and he came back to see me and he said, I've done the deal with Les. And I said, so for how much? And he told me this figure and I nearly fell out of my seat. And I said, we could have settled for far less than that. And he said, that's what I've done the deal at and that's what he's going to get paid. Fair enough. But so Capital had its own management style. So I think I knew that, you know, I wasn't going to be hanging around for too long.
So after a few conversations and some negotiation, you walked out of the door of BRMB. What was happening in your heart at that stage?
Well, there's no denying. I mean, it was a very awkward moment. It was made worse by the fact that my wife, who was also my PA, when I went, they thought it was unwise for her to stay. So she lost her job as well at the same time, which was very, very difficult for her. So they were difficult times. I mean, in some ways, I was very relieved to be out of it because I don't think I was or ever could have been a Capital animal. 95.8, Capital FM. I joined GWR as sort of manufactured job title as Special Projects Executive, which was anything that needed to be done that Ralph couldn't find somebody to do. And I did that for about 6 months. The group was really starting to grow then. We were acquiring radio stations. We reorganised the whole of the management of the group. We divided the country into regions. and I was appointed managing director, GWR Midlands. They were fantastic times because, you know, GWR then was really, really growing rapidly, and share price was just going through the roof. I mean, I remember coming home and saying, I'd got some share options in GWR at the time. I remember coming home to my wife and saying, tomorrow I'm going to be a 750,000 millionaire. And I remember her saying, why don't you sell the shares? And I said, well, A, I can't exercise the options at the moment, but B, if, you know, can I hang on to it worth 1.5 million? And I think the very next day, the bottom began to fall out of the market and the share price dropped. I mean, in common with virtually all commercial radio stocks, it wasn't just GWR. It was when, you know, it was when the dot-com bubble burst, you know, and they were just great days because, you know, the group was growing in confidence. We were acquiring radio stations. That whole process of acquiring a new radio station was, I mean, we got it, just cut it down to an absolute fine art, because you'd buy a radio station and a team of us would go in the next day to have a meeting with the staff, who'd all look like rabbits trapped in the headlights of an oncoming car, and they'd all be deeply suspicious of us. And GWR's reputation as being this sort of formulaic radio automaton that just used to, that preceded us when we arrived, and so, you know, they were all fearful for their jobs. But we'd got a great knack of talking them round.
The new 96 Trent FM with a better music mix of the 70s, 80s and today.
The station that you're helping us to build.
With ideas like the Hot
77. You know, they just were great days. You know, Classic FM was going from strength to strength. We'd got versions of Classic FM in Finland, in Holland, you know, all over the place. But the feeling was, particularly after the share price started to fall away, we needed to reorganise again. And when this cull happened, I knew that it was possibly on the cards that I would be one of the victims of that. But I wasn't, and a new post of group development director was created. That really had two aspects to it. One was to look after the group's corporate responsibility. And the other role that I played in that particular job was to apply for new radio licences. GWR had grown by acquiring other radio stations, by just going out and buying radio stations. And we'd been singularly unsuccessful in applying for new licences. So I was given this job, and whatever licence came up, we would put in an application for. I won't say money was no object, but we spent eye-watering amounts of money putting these applications together. We applied for West Midlands licence for a rock station. We applied for the Yorkshire licence. Whatever was going, the Radio Authority could expect an application from us. And very slowly it dawned on me, as I think Ralph knew all along, was that the Radio Authority expected us to apply because we were the largest radio group in the country, but they had absolutely no intention of ever awarding us a radio licence. And I thought, this is so demoralising, you know, knowing, and on day one, I know what the outcome is going to be, A, that we're not going to be successful, and B, we'll have spent an awful amount of money, and C, I will have wasted 6 months of my life putting this application together. So I just thought, I'm just not enjoying this anymore. And then there we had another major reorganisation, and there was an opportunity for me to take redundancy. And I don't think I ever thought I've had enough of radio. I don't think I was ever one of those people who are still around, who constantly hark back to the old days of commercial radio when it was all things to all people, when it had to be. And who say, oh, it's not the same as it used to be, and companies like GWR ruined commercial radio, and all radio stations are the same now. Whichever radio station you turn on, they're playing the same track, they're playing Adele over and over again. I've never been one of those people. I've always accepted that the industry has got to move on. But whether it's the sort of industry that I would now want to work in, and I think when I finally left GWR, I think I'd sort of reached that point where I thought, I'm not sure that this is the sort of thing that's going to give me ongoing career satisfaction anymore.
Ian, you've achieved a great deal in some changing times for the industry. How would the young Ian Rufus feel looking at what the older Ian Rufus achieved?
I think, like a lot of people, if they're to be perfectly honest with themselves, I think always gone through my career thinking any day now they'll find me out. Somebody will say, ah, actually, you know, you're not as good as you think you are. I think you've got to be a bit of a social psychopath if you, you know, if you've got so much confidence in your own abilities that you never doubt them. But looking back, you know, I mean, there are some things that I would have done differently. Some of the merger decisions that I made were probably the wrong ones. But, you know, looking back, you know, Mercia was a great achievement. You know, in profitability terms, we really, really turned BRMB around. Extra AM was a phenomenally successful achievement. Phenomenally successful achievement. Not all my own work, but it was on my watch. Also, the fact that I was there on day one of legal land-based commercial radio and survived that awful year at LBC. The one thing I do think, though, is because of the nature of the industry, that it's generally speaking a young person's industry, was then, still is, and probably always will be, probably how quickly you're forgotten. You know, young, ambitious journalists and presenters who are going to be the, you know, the stars and the captains of the industry of the future. If they'd have said, oh, that guy over there is Ian Rufus and he was managing director of this radio station for 6 years in the late 80s and early 90s, they probably would have no idea who I was. And as things move on, you know, people fade into the background. But I'm still very proud of the fact that I was certainly at one time one of the longest surviving original members of commercial radio from those early days of LBC. So, you know, to look back over a career of that length and, you know, it's been pretty eventful.
And how would you like to be remembered?
I guess it's going back to the Mercia days, that we built a radio station there in very uncertain economic times, and the team of people who put that radio station together, and certainly as the person who programmed that radio station and appointed all the presenters, we turned that very, very quickly into one of the huge success stories of commercial radio. And I think the reputation of Mercia and what we achieved with that radio station, I hope will never be forgotten. That achievement, I think, is what I'm most proud of, and I think what I'd most like to be remembered for.